On the program today, trying to foresee the inflation future. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Risnell. It is Thursday today, the 11th of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to do a little inflation 1-2 punch at the top of the show to get things going. Yesterday, the news was inflation at the consumer level. The Consumer Price Index, which showed inflation while still high, is coming down noticeably. Today, it's the producer price index, inflation at the wholesale level. The PPI last month up 2.3%, the lowest reading since January of 2021. And that is good. Yes, because what happens with PPI eventually happens with CPI too. Kinda? Sometimes? Maybe? Marketplace's Kristen Schwab starts us off.
I went on a reporting journey today that started out innocent enough to figure out what the producer price index can and can't tell us about the consumer price index. But things got pretty existential pretty fast. Betsy Stevenson is an economist at the University of Michigan.
You know, actually, I think it's a really good idea to even start with what is inflation.
Oh, boy. What Stevenson means is there is no one measure of inflation. CPI, PPI, they each have strengths and weaknesses in evaluating prices. The government has a producer price index because...
if it's going up, what do you think they're probably going to do? Well, eventually, they'll raise prices to consumers.
They being businesses. And this makes a lot of sense. If the cost of food for restaurants goes up, eating will probably cost more. It's a way the producer price index trickles down into the consumer price index. But this doesn't mean PPI can totally predict what'll happen to consumer prices. John O'Tracoon is an economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond.
There's a lot of things that are going on that would make that relationship of PPI feeding into CPI very different.
For one, consumers buy imported goods, and the PPI doesn't measure that because it's centered on domestic producers. Another, PPI is more volatile because businesses are hesitant to raise prices the second their costs go up. And the biggest discrepancy is housing. It's not included in the PPI. Meanwhile, it makes up a third of the CPI.
It's one of the pieces of CPI that's actually keeping the CPI quite elevated right now.
And why producer prices look a bit sunnier than consumer prices. So what's the point of all this then? Why do we cover all these economic acronyms week after week? Here's Stevenson again.
More measures are always better at giving us more precision in our predictions. So are different measures of inflation all pointing in the same direction?
She says the rate of inflation for both indexes is ticking down, and that's a good sign for inflation overall. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, sorry, hang on, just checking. Nope, still no worries about the debt limit on Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Thursday today means we got an update this morning on the number of people making their first applications for unemployment benefits. Those claims rose 22,000 last week, a bit more than expected. 264,000 is the number of people put out of work. That is the most since late 2021. And yes, I know we have talked about how volatile these weekly updates on first-time claims can be. And that's why I'm going to mention that the four-week moving average, a tad bit smoother, is also the highest it's been since late 2021. Could be some evidence that the labor market and thus perhaps the economy are cooling. Slowly. Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports.
The first question I always have whenever any data comes out is, what does it tell us about the economy? Sometimes I get conflicting answers, but today, when I asked economists Erica Groshen, Gary Hoover, and Heidi Shierholz what the latest unemployment numbers tell us, they all said some version of the same thing.
Soft landing?
Soft landing.
Soft landing.
Now, none of them is saying the Fed has achieved that elusive soft landing, but Heidi Shierholz at the Economic Policy Institute says so far that does seem to be where we're headed.
We see inflation coming down and unemployment not yet going up.
Even though first-time unemployment claims are inching up, they're not up that much, and the unemployment rate is still low, just 3.4%.
I do always have the concern in the back of my mind, will we start to see layoffs increasing substantially? I definitely do not take today's UI numbers as any kind of obvious confirmation of that at all.
That could still change, but Gary Hoover at Tulane agrees that right now it's looking like the Fed may be getting things right.
And that's actually rather surprising to me. I thought we were going to crash down.
So when and how will we actually be able to say with any confidence that the Fed has achieved that soft landing? I asked Erica Groshen at Cornell.
Well, we've never really had a soft landing before.
If it happens this time, we may only know in hindsight. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
In this era of banking weirdness, I suppose, maybe it's time to try something new with your money, like, oh, I don't know, banking with a tech company? As of a couple of weeks ago, if you've got an Apple card, you can open a savings account through Apple as well, offering a quite tidy, thank you very much, interest rate of 4.15%. And a whole lot of people have, according to Forbes, within the first couple of days, Apple and its partner Goldman Sachs had pulled in a cool $1 billion in deposits. Tara Morrison is a senior reporter at Vox. Her deposit was among that $1 billion. She wrote about the whole thing. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You opened up one of these Apple savings accounts. First of all, what was it like? A couple of taps and boom, you were in?
Yeah, it was shockingly easy. Like Apple products are always pretty easy, but you know, the last time I opened up a savings account with another bank, it was a much longer and more complicated process. And this was literally like a few taps.
On the theory that you already have the Apple card and you've got Apple Pay and you're probably pretty comfortable with Apple, I do wonder, though, how shockingly frictionless it was to give Apple more access to your money.
I mean, there's always considerations about like how much should one company have of me. And certainly like your financial life is a big part of that. I had those concerns when I opened up the Apple card, which, you know, you have to get the savings account. That is, a concern, but it's also a 4.15% interest rate on the savings account. So,
which ain't nothing, right? I do wonder, though, what Apple's reputation for frictionless service, which, on pretty much all of its products, means for competitors in this space, because they now, it's not like you're locked in, but your savings account is on your phone. And man, that's pretty easy.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing that Apple does notoriously is it has a ton of control over its devices.
Right.
This is all within its wallet app.
If somebody had said to you, maybe 8 years ago, that Apple was going to have a savings account, what would your reaction have been?
I mean, absolutely not. I didn't ever see why they'd want to do it, why anybody would want to use Apple as their savings account when there are banks. For me, I'm a little old. Apple was a computer maker. now it's a whole lot more. You know, it's in your car. It's in your financial life. It's in your, you know, health services. I mean, it's everywhere. And it makes sense that banks would be in there. But when you think about it, it's come such a long way, like so fast into so many things.
So what's next? Are we going to see like an Apple mortgage app? And are we going to see, like a Robinhood-y kind of thing where you can actively trade? I mean, you know, in theory, Tim Cook and the gang in Cupertino are looking for more ways to get their hands on more of your money.
Yeah, in theory, I'm not sure how much further they want to go into financial services because, you know, you get into a whole thing of regulations. I mean, Apple is not an actual bank. They've teamed up with Goldman Sachs to like provide that banking, you know, service. But they do have like a buy now, pay later service that's fairly new, which they set up their own sort of like loan company to do. So it's not out of the realm of possibility that they'd expand that. But, you know, you have to think, what's the business interest for Apple to do that? But I wouldn't rule it out. I wouldn't rule anything out.
Yeah, well, let me ask you this, though. You said you're getting 4.15% on your Apple savings account now. How much has that meant for you in, like, the 3 weeks that they've had your money?
I have gotten an interest payment so far. It's been about 3 weeks. It was like, I think more in that month than I've gotten in the last year, possibly 2 years, maybe three of my previous high yield savings account. So it is significant. I was very happy to see it.
High yield in air quotes there. But that's kind of what I'm saying, right? I mean, they've made this very attractive for you to give them more access.
Yeah. I mean, when I saw the 4.15% and I looked at like my then current savings account, which was a fraction of that, I was actually kind of mad at my whole bank. And I said, no, I'm going to go with an FDIC insured, which this is, account that gives me as much money as possible. I'm going to, you know, there's inflation. I feel like I'm losing money at a certain point when the interest rate's not high enough. So I might as well be losing slightly less money with this.
Sarah Morrison. She's a senior reporter at Vox, talking about Apple and its financials. Sarah, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
The Biden administration is out with some proposed new rules today about emissions from coal and gas-fired power plants. There's a whole lot of politicking yet to go before these rules actually take effect. But as written, part of the plan requires those power plants to be equipped with systems that can capture carbon, the goal being to remove 90% of that industry's greenhouse gas emissions by 2035. There is, you should know, a big pot of money for carbon capture in last year's Inflation Reduction Act, and you are going to be hearing a whole lot about it in the years to come. So Marketplace's Lily Jamali has today's explainer.
Picture for a moment the smokestacks at a power plant. You can close your eyes for this, unless you're driving, in which case, please don't. Those smokestacks are designed to let carbon, produced while making power, escape.
You can't just stick a straw into an emissions point source and just grab CO2 because it's in low concentration.
UT Austin's Tip Meckel says one carbon capture method isolates carbon dioxide and attaches it to a liquid.
You want the CO2 to be absorbed into the liquid so that you can collect it and concentrate it.
And store it underground. But this is expensive. The main policy encouraging carbon capture is called the 45Q tax credit. Mahmoud Abdulnaga of the Center for Climate and Energy Solutions said it's had a limited effect. But he says the Inflation Reduction Act's boost to the tax credit is changing that.
After the enhancement of 45Q, we have seen the announcement of so many projects all across the country.
He says carbon capture can work at scale if the infrastructure to move and store the carbon is there. For critics, that is a big caveat.
It's potentially a distraction.
Michael Mann is director of the Penn Center for Science, Sustainability, and the Media.
We need to use the technology that exists today to accomplish the task of lowering carbon emissions by 50% this decade.
Like renewables and more efficient use of the energy we already have. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we're committing to a theory that we are testing in the marketplace.
Which is what you got to do, I suppose. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 221 points today, 0.6%, 33,309. The NASDAQ ticked up 22 points, about 0.2%, 12,328. The S&P 500 down 7, also about 0.2%, 41.30. Disney shareholders reacted to the company's report yesterday that global Disney Plus subscribers are down some 4 million. Walt Disney shares dipped 0.8%. Sarah Marshall and I were just talking about Apple's push into banking, so let's have a look at some fintech stocks, shall we? Block, which owns Square, was off 0.4%. PayPal, well, by the way, remember PayPal? Gained 1.2%. Apple inched up about 0.1%. Google unveiled a bunch of new AI-powered products at its annual developers conference this week, including a feature called Magic Compose that helps users craft messages to sound more positive or professional, perhaps, or to mimic Shakespeare, apparently. Shares of Google's parent company, Alphabet, ticked up 4.3% on that Magic Compose thing. What could possibly go wrong? Am I right? Bonds rose, yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.38%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Title 42 ends tonight, the pandemic-era rule that let the United States quickly expel migrants. It is a huge shift in immigration policy, and what comes next is going to be a patchwork of old and new border policies that the Biden administration hopes will deter and also help manage border crossings while at the same time preserving legal paths to asylum. Migrants have been gathering by the thousands at the southwest border, and whether they've left their countries for political reasons or to escape persecution, part of the reason they are coming to the United States is economic. Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovall explains how the availability of jobs and the strength of the American economy help shape regional migration patterns.
Hola, ¿cómo estás?
Will Cardoso meets me at the front door of a gray brick one-story home in the Houston suburbs. A fluffy puppy strolls by as we move towards the kitchen. We sit at the table, and 21-year-old Cardoso jumps right in about life in Venezuela. The threats, the murders of friends and family, that time she was kidnapped by the police. And then there was the day men opened fire on her grandma's house. Cardoso's mom, Cora, says they escaped through the back door. They walked through the forest for hours to the nearby border with Colombia to flee the country. They're from Maracaibo, once a wealthy oil boom town. Now the city is rampant with poverty and violence after years of severe economic mismanagement and political oppression. Cardoso, her mom Cora, and two younger sisters flew to Mexico and crossed the Texas border near Laredo in January of 2021. They applied for asylum and temporary protected status. We're referring to the women under abbreviated names because they fear punishment for working without authorization. Once in Houston, Cardoso quickly found a restaurant job to support the family. But during her first week, she says she showed up late to work, and as a punishment, her manager asked her to take her top off. Afraid, she refused and quit. Then she got a $9 an hour job at a grocery store. Not bad, but a better paying job testing people for COVID-19 came along. She got COVID several times while testing so many people, but still she thought it was a good job for not having a work permit. But then she says her boss suddenly let her go and refused to pay her for her last 2 months on the job, around $6,000. Even so, the women say these experiences pale in comparison to what they faced in Venezuela. Cardoso's mom, Cora.
No era nada para lo que nosotros sufrimos en Venezuela.
Their story is one of millions of migrants who come to the southwest border and know that a job and better life awaits them on the other side in the largest economy in the world.
Between Venezuela and the United States, the increase in wages after migration could be as high as 20 or sometimes 100 times.
Dilip Ratha is a migration expert with the World Bank Group. He says, at the end of the day, people come to the U.S. because
employers in this country want them.
Ratha says any successful migration solution at the border has to take into account the implicit labor dynamics,
The U.S. has jobs that need to be filled. Migrants fill them.
Putting barriers at the border, that can delay things a bit, but it will create more distortions. And it will definitely reduce welfare on both sides for the origin countries, as well as welfare of the people and the employers in the United States.
And Ratha says that's because migrants who come to the U.S. grow the economy through labor supply, innovation, and entrepreneurship, like the Cardoso family. They started a new business selling arepas, a traditional Venezuelan snack, out of a cooler.
Vendo arepas. Todas vendemos arepas.
It's work that's relatively safe. And at $5 a pop, the family makes enough to cover the bills. I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
The latest data from the Census Bureau says almost 15 million housing units nationwide sit vacant. Most of them, houses and apartments, are actively for sale or for rent or are being used as second homes. But that does still leave millions of houses empty and abandoned, often run down and unlivable. From Colorado Public Radio, Dan Boyce has this story of a program to get those blighted homes back on the market.
Being a construction worker was not Brian Moreno's long-held dream. He had a job.
Auto body. I was in the body shop painting and just doing body work, but it wasn't paying enough, so.
Not paying enough because he's a new dad.
8 months old, my little daughter. So I just needed to get a job and something quick, you know, so start supporting my family.
So now he's learning how to put up new sheetrock in a dilapidated, century-old home. It's part of his course at nearby Trinidad State College, which will certify him as a construction worker in just 1 month.
We're committing to a theory that we are testing in the marketplace.
That's Colorado Attorney General Phil Weiser. His office received a chunk of money from a national settlement with the country's largest mortgage lenders after the Great Recession. Weiser used $5 million of that to create the Colorado Partnership for Education and Rural Revitalization.
And the theory is, if you train people to redevelop these properties, you do redevelop them, you'll sell them, improving the community, and the money will go back into the program and it will keep sustaining itself.
The revitalization program is at community colleges in southern Colorado. It's the poorest region of the state, where a boom and bust mining legacy in towns like Trinidad have left neighborhoods dotted with homes abandoned for decades. Back at the construction site where students are putting up sheetrock in that dilapidated home, program instructor Jerry Begley points to another house next door.
They actually look like little twins.
Or at least they used to look pretty much identical. Now this one has been almost entirely gutted and rebuilt. We step inside.
In the whole place, from what I see so far, light, homey, you know, modern.
Exactly. It's two bedroom, two bath, and it'll be very nice. It's all new plumbing, all new electrical.
This will be the first home from the AG's initiative to hit the market. Trinidad State is hoping to get about $220,000 for it, which would be a good deal for a house that size in the area.
We did purchase the kitchen cabinets.
With the initiative being new and with new students cycling through every month, it took Begley a long time to renovate this house.
About a year and a half.
That turnaround should speed up, and the money from selling the homes keeps the program going. But even though the initiative is now operating in four southern Colorado cities, it's not some grand solution to the region's housing needs. That's not the only point, though. Begley says it's the rapid workforce development, getting students trained for construction jobs in just a month.
We have an opportunity to take some people who might be down and out, who want a second, third, fourth, fifth chance to come in, and they say, we need a job.
For student Brian Moreno, he needed a new career fast, and this program has delivered.
I picked up a lot. Yeah, within 3 weeks, it's amazing.
Moreno has since finished the program and got that construction job he was looking for, a path to a higher wage to provide for his new family. And this struggling corner of the state really needs options like that. In Trinidad, Colorado, I'm Dan Boyce for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which carries the obligatory caveat, your mileage may vary. I saw this in the Wall Street Journal today, some data from the Conference Board that shows workers in this economy are happier than they have been in almost 40 years. A bit more than 62% of American workers said they were satisfied with their jobs last year. That is up from 60% in 2021. There were 26 data points in that survey, including commutes, people's coworkers, the physical workplace, also job security. All right, here is your moment of economic context. Do with this what you will. No movement on the debt limit in Washington, but Jamie Dimon is not wasting any time. The CEO of JPMorgan Chase said on Bloomberg TV today that he is convening weekly meetings on the fallout from a possible default. He's going to go daily in about 10 days and then three times a day if things get really bad. John Buckley, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Amir Bibawe is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.